Now, it used to be said that good movie roles could dry up for actors when they started to get older, and to really put lots of bums on cinema seats, you needed to be casting young, thrusting, good-looking talent. But perhaps that idea's in a bit of retreat these days. There are more and more good roles for senior actors and more senior folks, it seems, keen to get out and see them on screen in the cinema. And another such film is out this week. It's called The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, starring the familiar face of Jim Broadbent, but also Dame Penelope Wilton. Now, after TV comedies in the 1980s and roles in some big films like Sir Richard Attenborough's Cry Freedom, she's going from strength to strength now, well into her 70s. She's found legions of new fans as Isabel Crawley in the Downton Abbey TV series and movies. And the Netflix generation knows Penelope Wilton as the Widow Anne. She was the sidekick for Ricky Gervais' character in the series Afterlife on Netflix. But all this, of course, after a theatre career where she was cast by top directors, picked up top Olivier Awards, quite a back catalogue. So is Dame Penelope now bothered that all that she's done has been slightly overshadowed by these late career successes?
I'm delighted. I mean, those are the two current ones. I've been at it for quite a long time. So in the past, I got, when my daughter was quite young, I got enormous street cred because I was in a film, a zombie film called Shaun of the Dead.
yes, indeed.
And I had her friends coming round and staring at me because I had zombie eyes at the end. So, you know, it goes with it goes with what's current on at the moment. And before that, of course, there was Ever Decreasing Circles when I was younger, which was a... And then, of course, over here, I'm known in the theatre. So, you know, it depends who you're talking to and what generation, really, you're talking to.
Certainly. And, of course, I've also been told by Doctor Who fans, of which I'm not one, but that in the more modern incarnations of the canon, you played the Prime Minister.
I played, first of all, an MP who then became the Prime Minister. And then I was killed by the Daleks. And that was the beginning of the sort of renaissance of Doctor Who, when Russell T. Davies started writing scripts. And I'd worked with him on a program called Bob and Rose, and a television program. And he's a wonderful writer. So, yes, it was at the very early stages of the sort of second lot of Doctor Who's, the more modern lot.
Yeah, that would get you a fair amount of street cred, wouldn't it? More than a zombie with bursting bloodshot eyes at the end of Shaun of the Dead.
Absolutely. That with a certain generation and a certain group of people, actually, of all generations, they loved that. So I've been lucky in as far as... But, you know, my career has taken funny turns because I'm of an age now. And when I started, there was only two channels on the television. And I was in the theatre and, you know, you very rarely got a lot of television or film, indeed, because there was not HBO and all Netflix and all those things. So I started, like a lot of people, I started in the theatre and was in the theatre until, you know, until I was in sort of early middle age, really. And it was only then that I started to do other things, when all these other things were invented, like there was more channels, and they needed to fill them with, and also there were very talented writers.
Yes, if you think of something like Bob and Rose back in the day, I mean, that would have, as you said, a limited number of channels. That would have had a very large audience, more than a similar kind of comedy or drama in an evening slot these days, I guess. I can recall once actually talking to David Jason, who was, he might not have been in the greatest mood that day. I think he'd had to do a lot of interviews, but he was slightly grumpy, saying, look, you know, when I play Inspector Frost, I get 7 or 8 million people watching on ITV in primetime. If this was the States, you know, I'd be getting movie offers, and he wasn't quite getting those. But back then, I would guess that almost British television was almost like the British version of the film industry, wasn't it? And of course, all those programs lapped up in places like New Zealand and our broadcasters.
Yes, absolutely. And I think television has gone from strength to strength, actually, partly because, of course, with recent events, with the pandemic and everything, people haven't gone out so much to go and see things. They have stayed in their houses. So Of course, an industry caters for that. But I'm glad to say more people are going out. I went to the theatre the other evening and it was absolutely packed. And so theatre is coming back, and also people are going to the cinema more now. And cinema, the way people see things is a bit different now too, because you used to go to those big cinemas. Now there are a lot of sort of places called Picture House, and where you can get a drink and you can sit in a very comfortable chair.
Yes.
And you can film and you can meet friends and you can have dinner and all the rest of it. So people's ways of seeing things change, but I'm glad people are seeing things on a big screen again instead of on a little one in their, or sometimes an enormous one in their sitting room. But I think there's a sort of concentration you have when you see a film with other people. You go in as a sort of individual and you come out as a sort of community because you've all witnessed something at the same time.
So, and same for theatre, of course, as well. And I wonder, because I lived in the UK for a stretch ending about 20 years ago now, but at that time, of course, like in Europe, it's astonishing what's on in the West End and Shaftesbury Avenue, and you can see the classics, yeah. You know, Importance of Being Earnest or new stuff. And at that time, I think there was a bit of a phase where some Hollywood actors were coming out and wanting to get a bit of their theatre cred and theatre chops. Even they were then quite young, like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck. Nicole Kidman did a big run in a Covent Garden theatre that was tiny, and people yes. loved it. Does that sort of thing go on now? Has that all been disrupted by the pandemic as well?
The West End has been disrupted, I have to say. I'm going to be doing a play in the autumn, which is a comedy, but it's the first play I've done in the West End for quite a while. And there are a lot of musicals because the theatre was closed and they have to remunerate, and musicals get a much bigger audience, as you can understand, than a straight play. But I'm glad to say that some straight plays are coming back into the West End. And of course, we have subsidised, like you do, subsidised theatre, like the National Theatre. And we have smaller theatres, like you mentioned, the Nicole Kidman did at the Donmar Theatre. So there's always theatre going on, but it has taken a bit of a nosedive when we had the COVID. And I'm glad to say that people are coming back into the theatre because there's a lot of very interesting writers now.
I wonder if it put people's noses out of joint when Hollywood types were coming over from the US and pretty much taking over runs of plays and then disappearing again. Did people object to that?
Well, I think we did the same in Broadway. So I don't think that we've got anything to complain about. No, there's a cross sort of fertilization with America. You know, if it suits the play, then fine. And often they were American plays. But we've taken things there with all English actors that require. And I know there are shows going to go there later on in the year that have played very well here, and will do very well on Broadway. But the casts are often English, not all of them, but quite a lot of them, and often the main part is who has created over here will do it over in New York as well.
I suppose the British did it with pop music back in the day, didn't they, with the British Invasion? So fair dues if the American actors want to come over to have a crack at the West End. But of course, Downton Abbey is also a movie, isn't it? So that's almost two movies.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, almost the best of all worlds. But your character, Isabel Crawley, I mean, that's the one where when I name the program, they automatically identify with you. A complex character, a moderniser, and yet of course it's a old-fashioned, olden days type production, if I could call it that. But she is an interesting character, wasn't she, on the cusp of what now might be called liberal attitudes, but pushing back against restrictions of the time.
Yes. Yes, I think when we started, it was the year 1912. And by the time we finished the series and the two films, I think it was about 1926 or 1927. So in that period, when she arrived, because she's the mother of the heir, Isabel is the mother of the heir to the Crawley estate and Lord Grantham. He's a distant cousin, but Lord Grantham only has girls. So when she arrives, She's not posh enough for the aristocracy in the upstairs, and she certainly isn't posh enough to be served by the people downstairs, because she's sort of seen as being middle class and not quite the right thing. So she has a sort of difficult start. But actually, I think Julian Fellowes used her character to introduce all these different layers of sort of society in to the audience, because they could identify with her and with her difficulties, either upstairs or downstairs, and how she sort of managed her new life, because she didn't want to come anyhow with her son. And she was perfectly happy living a rather more fruitful life, I think, wherever she was before. I think it was in the north, Manchester or somewhere. Mm. And so it was a very interesting craft, but mostly it was interesting because my relationship with the old Lady Grantham, Maggie Smith, because he wrote us very good scenes where we had a good go at each other, but ended up being extremely fond, and that relationship grew over the years we were doing it.
Mm. So you spoke about theatre and how important that was to you, and of course you're very good at it, carrying off Olivier Awards and all of that sort of thing over the years. But is it true that The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which is beginning its run here this week, was actually, at first I thought it was adapted because I know it was a novel that was on the Booker Prize long list, but was it also a radio play, do you know, before it was
a
novel?
Yes, it was. I think originally Rachel Joyce wrote for radio, and then she did originally write it for radio in, I think, a slightly different version of Harold Fry, and then she wrote the novel, which was enormously successful about 10 years ago, and then she was approached to do the screenplay, and she told me that actually if she'd been approached 10 years ago, she was far too near to the material and she wouldn't have been able to see it as a film, but given the time in between, she was able to look at it with a fresh eye, and then she adapted it for the film as a film, and I think she's adapted the story very well. There's a lot of description of Harold Fry's journey. It's a story of a man who goes seemingly for no reason but except a great fondness for an old colleague to save her. He gets convinced that he can save her if he walks from Devon right up to Berwick-on-Tweed, which is in the north, nearly in Scotland, and he will get there and he will save her from... She's in a hospice, and he leaves his wife, who he seems to have a rather fractious relationship with, at home. And she doesn't know where he's gone. And she has to go on another journey of self-understanding while he does his sort of physical journey. So yes. It's very interesting and extremely moving story of two people who have to come to terms with a great sadness. I'm not going to say, because I don't want to ruin the story for people who are going to see. But they have a great sadness that they've shared in their lives. And they have, she particularly, Maureen, has found it very difficult to get through that. And so it has affected their marriage. She's a wonderful writer, Rachel. She's written two sequels to it, one about the lady that Harold goes to visit called Queenie. And then she's just written a novella called Maureen and the Angel from the North, which is a big statue by Anthony Gormley, right up north of England. And so I think she's done an extremely good job. And Hetty MacDonald, who directed it, has been able to bring that to life.
Yes, so Hetty MacDonald, people might know from the series Normal People, which was available here on demand and I think screened on by TVNZ, our national television broadcaster. And I wouldn't have picked it unless I'd read about it first. I did the wrong thing here, by the way, Penelope. I read the reviews before I watched the film, which you possibly wouldn't have approved of. But when I saw that it was her, there's a sort of sparseness I sensed, which was a bit like the Normal People series, where there's quiet. She's not afraid of quiet and pauses.
No.
And your people aren't speaking at all. And at first, almost almost no music or even no atmospheric sound at all. But then sparingly, it does come through and, of course, it adds to the drama of it as well. Was that a deliberate, is that her way of working?
Oh, yes. And also that was written into the script. I mean, there's a lot of scenes when I'm just by myself, so I wouldn't be talking to anyone anyhow. And she's having to deal with this difficult, this awful sadness, and trying and feeling that will her husband ever come home by herself. So it's coming to terms with a lot of things within four walls, without going for a journey in her own head. And that is very much part of the book. So the silence and the remunerative feeling of those scenes is very important.
Mm. And there is one of the reviews I read did sum it up this way, saying his wife Maureen, your character, hurt and confused by her husband's abandonment, vacuums despondently. And I thought that did you a bit of a disservice, because there's one opening scene in the early part of the film where you're doing a bit of vacuuming, but otherwise it's a lot more intense than that, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yes. Yes, it is. I don't know what to say about that.
I thought it was odd that the reviewer would pick that up as if your despondent vacuuming, which is a fleeting scene, was somehow, summed up the whole thing. But what I thought was interesting about the film is what you described there of the torment, you know, the things that we see, that's why Harold is going on this pilgrimage, the redemption, the salvation, or whatever that he's seeking, is actually revealed to us quite subtly, isn't it? In fact, one reviewer here says it starts like some sort of cozily familiar tale of, you know, you think you're going to see something about British eccentricity or an eccentric in Harold, but it's actually not that at all, isn't it? As it goes through, it's very cunningly revealed, very subtly revealed to the audience, just what it is has gone on that's fractured the relationship of this couple.
Yes, I think that's true to say. I think it reveals itself as the journey goes on, as they both make their journeys. I think that's very well described, yes.
Well, I'm talking to Dame Penelope Wilton. She's a co-star in the film beginning this week, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, the Harold Fry character played by Jim Broadbent. And Penelope Wilton also, of course, the star of Ever-Decreasing Circles, a situation comedy with Richard Briers back in, I think, the 1980s. Would that be right?
I think so, yes.
Yes, and, of course, the character of Isabel Crawley more recently in Downton Abbey and Anne in Afterlife alongside Ricky Gervais on Netflix. And as we discovered earlier, for a time playing the Prime Minister on Doctor Who until she was taken out, unfortunately, by the Daleks. One fascinating detail upon reading what the RNZ Research Division pulled together about The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry was that it had, before it had its red carpet opening night in London, it had the day before one more modest premiere in the town of Kingsbridge, which I think was where the home of Maureen and Harold was sighted in the film. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
And there is a lovely account here that our researchers have uncovered. This is from the Ivy Bridge and South Brent Gazette, saying a very fortunate 160 people were the first to see this exclusive screening in the Merlin Cinema in Kingsbridge. And it says here, buried in the middle of the story, I love these two lines put together. It is the story of the human desire to help one another, and the postbox you can see in it that was used is next to the Fika Coffee House in Kingsbridge. So some real local detail there.
Yes, wonderful. I was busy doing a lot of press, so I didn't go to that screening, but I'm delighted that they had it there first, and quite right too.
Oh, it's a fantastic account. I'll send you the Ivy Bridge and South Brent Gazette's version of it. The general manager of the cinema says, we expect this to be the biggest film of the year in our cinema, even though it's got stiff competition. And the article, which has a lot of detail, goes on to say the building was a neoclassical style, completed in 1850. It's arcaded on the ground floor so that butter and poultry could be sold. Lots of detail.
Oh, how fascinating.
Yeah, yes. Lots of detail in the Ivy Bridge and South Brent Gazette. But when as I was saying, it's the sadness, the real intensity of the film, which comes in the later part. There's one line where Hughes are challenged by Harold about joining this pilgrimage, and you say, no, I wouldn't have my things. And he's saying, you don't need things. Mm-hmm. He's shedding all this stuff. And at that point, we don't really quite know why he's done it, because he's not really fit for the task of walking 500 miles up to Scotland. But it is about the choices that some people make, isn't it, for whether you stay, whether you go, whether you give it all away if things really aren't working, or you stick it out?
Your question is, the thing is, not many people can suddenly drop everything and start walking to Berwick-on-Tweed. There's something that Harold feels he has to do because he's failed in other areas of his life, and subconsciously he doesn't think he was a success with the great sadness that they had with their son. So he feels that he has an impetus to do something to save somebody. And Maureen, of course, doesn't have those feelings. Also, she's a woman who requires her things because you don't suddenly drop everything. You build around you this sort of fortress of the things you own and your house, and that has been her safety. She doesn't like to go out much because she doesn't trust the world. She's angry, and grief takes you in a lot of different ways. It makes you angry. It makes you sad. It makes you hit out at people, and also it can ruin relationships unless you face up and are able to speak about them. And that's what they haven't been able to do. So it's a study of grief, apart from a lot of things, and the way different people react to an enormous cataclysmic happening in their lives. So I think it's very well judged by Rachel.
Well, you mentioned that Rachel had adapted this from her own play and then novel. And I believe it was largely one of those, I guess, like a lot of new things we're seeing now, would have been worked upon during the period of the pandemic, even during lockdown itself.
Yes.
And I wonder, here in New Zealand, we've seen, say, for example, a kind of, I guess you'd call it a docudrama about the politics and the political management of the pandemic, starring Kenneth Branagh as Boris Johnson, which was a bit of a leap when you first saw it. But is there going to be a lot of drama, you think, that either is directly about the COVID pandemic like that, or just somehow influenced by it, as it seems Rachel Joyce had certainly influenced what she was doing working on the screenplay of Harold Fry?
I don't think Rachel Joyce was, she was able to do the working on the screenplay of Harold Fry because there was a pandemic, and she's a writer, she can write at any time. But she wanted to write this with Hetty, and she was at Bristol University with Hetty MacDonald. So they sort of worked on it together as a screenplay. As far as the pandemic is concerned, it's extraordinary how quickly you forget about things that are very unpleasant. So I don't know how much we will be revisiting that dramatically. I think that the politics of it will certainly go on, and at the moment there is a big COVID investigation by the government and as to the goings on while we were in the pandemic, and whether we dealt with it in the way that we should have done, and who was to blame if we fell short of what was required. So I think those ramifications politically will go on. I'm not sure whether people will want to. I think there's a great feeling of escaping from it now.
Mm-hmm.
That's my opinion. I mean, that is strictly my own opinion.
Sure. But yeah, possibly it wouldn't be popular or a draw card to draw on that as a subject. Yeah, we'll have to see.
No.
One thing I wonder is we get a lot of our news and entertainment from the UK. It's a familiar source of ours, as I guess a part of the Anglosphere, if you could put it like that. But do you think that, I mean, we heard in years gone by, it seemed, people saying that roles would dry up for actors once they, you know, become senior in their profession, unless you're sort of Clint Eastwood or something like that, where you can
yeah.
probably do whatever you want and he directs his own stuff. But it seems to me right now that when you look at what's on in the movies here in New Zealand, there's quite a lot from the UK still, but most of it featuring, you know, senior seasoned actors, if I could put it that way. And is this a real growth area? This is just sort of creep now advancing in the last sort of 10, 15 years.
I don't think most things have got senior players in at all. But I think that people are recognizing that there are people who survive beyond the age of 25. So, you know, we did the Marigold Hotel films, Best Exotic Marigold Hotel films, two of those about the senior people who go to retire in India. Those were very successful. So I think that people are recognizing that it's all to do with if people will pay money to go to things. And there is an audience for films that aren't just the superhero films, I think. I think people are recognizing perhaps that there are interesting stories in all walks of life.
I also, in the articles here about your work and career in the theatre, it's said here you once told the theatre critic Michael Billington that when you were giving masterclasses to actors, you'd tell students to do less acting. And says here, I'm not a fan of big acting, it quotes you at as well. No. Is that the same as overacting? Is this a bit of a scourge and perhaps the sort of understatement we talked about
earlier? Just think, if you're young, you just don't have to do as much. And it depends what you're doing. Of course, on the stage, you're using your whole physical body because you're having to hit the back of the auditorium and there are 5,000 people watching you. Whereas in film, you can have close-ups. So they've got to know what you're thinking. So there are, you know, horses for courses. But I don't care for exaggeration because that's not true to life, I don't think. You have to stay within the limits of what you're given and make that tell and not over-egg things. Because if you can see the acting, I think you're taken out of it. I think it's much better if you remain within the realms of possibility of the character you're playing.
Well, I think that certainly reflects Maureen in The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry, which is in the cinemas from next week. And from what you told us there, it sounds like Rachel Joyce working on more. So we may indeed see Maureen back on the screen in future roles.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for joining us on RNZ National this Saturday morning. Dame Penelope Wilton, thank you.
Thank you.